The Last Bohemians.
Hello everyone and welcome to The Last Bohemians presents Hilma on Screen at Tate Lates. I'm Kate Hutchinson and I started The Last Bohemians podcast in 2019 to meet and to celebrate maverick and radical women in arts and culture. And when it comes to someone who totally meets that description, I can't think of anyone else who meets it better than Swedish painter and mystic Hilma af Klint. Joining me to discuss that work and her really quite bohemian lifestyle is Amrita Dali, the Tate's Assistant Curator of International Art, and Lily Cole, activist and actor who plays Matilda in the film Hilma that's just come out on Viaplay. We're going to be learning about Matilda and her role in The Five, and I'll also be diving into the audience sort of Ricky Lake style with a microphone so that you get to ask some questions at the end. So Rita, maybe we can start with you. There's the film, there's a new biography that's just come out about Hilma by Julia Voss, and of course there's this incredible Tate exhibition with Mondrian, Forms of Life. Why is the world, to use your phrase, so hungry for Hilma right now?
I think on a very basic level, when you stand in front of her work, it immediately draws you in, it radiates, it's vibrant, the color palette is so just fantastical, it's whimsical, it's everything that I think people want in art, especially when we're coming out of such a dark, dark period. When you then take the time to get to know Hilma, you realize that she led this fantastic life that we'll get into more later, and that she had this really interesting process of making art, a mediumistic process, a way that it was also collective. She channeled spirits in order to make this art. So I think people are also drawn in by the mystery around her art process. It's not something that we're necessarily familiar with. It's not necessarily just a traditional art practice. But I think going back to when you have the experience of being in and around her image worlds, you realize as well that she's on this quest for the truth. And I think a lot of us are on something quite big like that, because we want answers. We want to understand how things are connected with one another. That's something that she said right at the beginning of the film, is that she wants to understand how everything's connected, from the plant world to the animal world, the human world, the spirit world. So for an artist and a body of work to encompass all of that in a way that is quite fantastical, I think people are just drawn in.
Wow. I mean, there's so much to dig into here. But what I'm interested in also is, you know, she wasn't just a last bohemian, she was also a lost bohemian. I mean, her work was ignored for years and years and years. And Lily, you studied art history, right? When did you first come across Hilma af Klint's work?
I'd come across her work visually before, but her name and the stories around her I came across when I was sent the script. And that sort of blew my mind. I was like, whoa, I studied art history for 3 years and her name just didn't exist in the textbooks. And I think that's also maybe part of the excitement around her work, is this reckoning also with the way we've understood and written history, needing correction to be a bit more herstory. She's one of maybe many other artists that I think are being reclaimed, and there may be others, you know, in years to come that find their voice finally when it wasn't recognized when they were alive.
I mean, I'm guessing that in preparation for the film, you saw her paintings up close before, but I know also you've just walked around the exhibition, and I'd love to know, just from your perspective, how do you feel when you look at these paintings for the second time?
To be honest, today is the first time I've seen many of them, because when we made the film, her paintings were actually, I think they were in Australia at the time, so it was very hard to see them. I saw paintings that were a few of the smaller pieces that were in Stockholm Museum at the time, and then I've seen another show in Stockholm since then. So some of the paintings I'd seen, but a lot of them I hadn't, and yet I've spent a lot of time looking at them and learning about them. So just today, it was kind of amazing to walk around and see the size of them, the feel of them, the texture of them, the relation. It's very, very evocative, powerful work. I did find in the exhibition the Ether Room fascinating, the way in which that room explores the wider cultural movements that were happening. I was excited to see Carl Jung's, read some of his paintings from the Red Books in there. to start to like notice the connections between this wider, maybe collective unconscious movement that was emerging amongst artists, but also amongst like philosophers and thinkers and writers. Yeah, I kind of geeked out a bit in that room.
That leads on into talking about this mystical element. What was going on in the time that Hilma was going to art school in Stockholm and she was getting involved with other artists? The spirituality movement was sort of at full pelt, really.
There was so much happening to the point that I can't connect with how that must have felt and what that would have been like to be exposed to so many things. Because on one hand, you have all of the things that were fermenting in the spiritual philosophical spaces. You had theosophy, which plays a big part in both Hilma af Klint's life and those who were in her circles. So theosophy, it's quite hard to explain because there isn't just this one value system around it, but essentially it is that all world religions share this truth, share this path. And it is a thought system that takes or borrows from Islam, Buddhism, as well as Christianity, Hinduism. So what is also quite exciting when you think about how she connected to other religions is that she was thinking globally and transnationally as well. But at the same time, you had occultism and spirituality speaking to scientific innovations as well. So imagine at that time, the X-ray is being invented, gamma rays, radiation and radioactive waves, Marie Curie winning the Nobel Prize, all of these things happening, all of these technologies that are enabling people to see things that were unseen before. Also, just imagine the fact that in her own ancestry, her family were naval officers and cartographers. So this instinct to document that which is unseen but is felt in the world is something that I think that she draws on, and it's very present in the film, but it's something that propels her to keep making art like this. But what's so exciting is that all of these, I guess, fields of knowledge, now we see them as very separate. But at the time, they were all speaking to each other. You know, a lot of scientists were also theosophists. And also at the same time, you had all of the innovations and revelations in natural sciences and physical sciences. So we also have a moment in the exhibition where we look at her botanical illustrations and the fact that she spent a lot of time developing this very close observation, this ability to do very scientific, precise illustrations of these flowers, and the same for Mondrian as well. So the fact that she was just this vessel for all of these innovations, I think explains why there's such a dense imagery when you look at her work.
The turn of the 20th century was like a fascinating time. And when I studied art history, it was the time that excited me the most, because you look at art history and you look at that, like, imagery didn't really change that significantly for centuries, century upon century. I mean, of course, you can see subtle shifts. I'm not trying to simplify it, but by and large, it was largely representational, right? And then suddenly in the 20th century, it just kept changing and changing and changing and changing. And that's obviously reflective of many other things in society that were changing, that there was actually the freedom to be allowed to start questioning religion and spirituality that hadn't actually been allowed previously, when it was very dangerous to question the church or question the status quo. All the scientific breakthroughs, technological breakthroughs, like, it seems to be a very fervent time. And I think art reflects how much was in culture maybe being questioned and changed. And also then trade routes, you know, the fact that you had lots of Eastern ideas coming into Europe and ideas like reincarnation or Hindu ideas or Buddhist practices informing the kind of understanding of how the world works and spirituality. It's a fascinating moment to look at.
So Hilma was studying at art school in Stockholm, and then she finds a group of women, the five, De Femme. And I think it would be great to watch a clip from the film where we meet this group of women. We see this group of women all in discussion, and then to talk about their role in Hilma's life.
I saw it.
You really saw them?
What do you mean?
No one. I don't understand.
They want us to paint the invisible worlds.
Hilma, we could lose our souls.
Cornelia.
There are, of course, risks. We must understand that.
There are risks. Hans Josephson's gone completely mad.
Wait, it's not fair. He was already mad. He's a man.
He's been signed in his artworks with the names of dead artists.
We're not doing that.
It's dangerous.
But I don't understand. We've all been chosen for this assignment?
They wanted to be a painter. But we can all take part. Right, Anna?
But we'll all help out. Right? Mm.
Of course.
Hilmer and Anna, who told you that?
It came from the spirits.
Well, I'm a painter too.
Of course you are. It's just...
I guess you don't have the education, Cornelia.
I didn't have that opportunity.
Look, we are all chosen. We are all chosen.
It's important work.
For this to succeed, we all need to contribute. And are you all accepting of the assignment or the hard work that comes with it?
Yes. Yes.
We're ready.
Dramatic ending there. So, Hilmer had been painting, she'd been studying painting, doing quite sort of naturalistic paintings of landscapes, right? And then she meets this group of women. What's this scene about, Lily? Who are we meeting here? Who are we seeing around this dinner table?
Oh, I just love that they called themselves De Femme. I think that says a lot. It's like they were branded themselves, this identity as a collective. The five, De Femme means, obviously. And we know that these women met, as five of them, clearly, for around 10 years, maybe more, pretty much weekly, and held seances where they believed they were communicating with the spirit world. And through that communication, felt this sense of mission and purpose to the work that they needed to create. Also probably discussing politics, philosophy, you know, many other aspects. There were also maybe queer relationships within the group. I love that in the exhibition here, you have some of De Femme's drawings. And I'd recommend if any of you go back to the show or you look to the show to seek those out. They're in the same room, the Ether Room. Those blew my mind when I first saw those in Stockholm Museum, because the imagery, they're relatively small, they're this big perhaps, but the imagery is so similar. It's the infinity symbols, it's the geometrical patterns, it's the floral. It's basically the drafting of what became the abstract paintings that arguably are the first or some of the first abstract paintings in the Western art world. Interestingly, those are not necessarily attributed to Hilmer, they're attributed to the group. And we know that Anna was a very active artist. We know that Cornelia was an artist. Sigrid was a medium. My character, Matilda, was the editor of several spiritual magazines at the time. The assumption can be that Matilda and Sigrid probably helped encourage this group of girls towards spiritual practice and seances and spiritual ideas. And then they were collectively exploring and creating the first sketches of this later work, which then Hilmer at some point encouraged them to turn into paintings. And actually, we believe that all five of them were working. And maybe actually, there was actually an article in Art Forum quite recently saying it could have been up to 13 women, others beyond the five, working on those massive paintings.
We've been told, or we see maybe, Hilmer as this sort of lone genius, but actually there was a whole crew of them working together late at night, doing these drawings, which then formed the inspiration.
I think for me, it's like the most maybe powerful part of the story is this aspect. It's like the desire to rewrite art history goes beyond then just taking like this argument of like, well, was Kandinsky the first, or was Mondrian the first Western abstract artist? Oh no, now we're going to put a woman as the first. Yeah, great, powerful. But what if actually more important is to say it's not a single lone genius, and it's never probably ever a single lone genius, that not to undermine Hilmer's genius, clearly plenty of it, but that actually there's often a collective behind great movements. And maybe there's even a collective unconscious that was bubbling up amongst many different creators at that time. And for me personally, I think that's a much more radical and interesting idea to explore. And I don't know that Hilmer necessarily would have even disagreed with that narrative. You know, she credits Anna Cazell as a collaborator on many of these works. She seemingly was not so egocentric about it. You know, one of the works we published 20 years after her death. So we don't know actually how she would have wanted them to be positioned today. Mm.
I think also for me, what I'm starting to kind of distance myself more and more from is even just attributing abstract artists to her, which I know seems a bit like it's undermining the premise of the exhibition or even just how we're thinking about her work. Because I think I'm not even sure how concerned she was about thinking about abstract art. I think it's just this is the language, the aesthetic language that poured out of her fire many different kinds of messages. And this is what she wanted to convey to the world. And I think also when you're talking about ego, you know, I think she also is known to say that, you know, I'm not even painting these images. Something is coming through me. My hand is being guided, which is also kind of part of the process of automatic writing and drawing. But I think there's something quite, I don't know, something really lovely about she's really just seeing herself as this vessel.
I love the idea as well that you guys are touching on, I think, with this exhibition, that we assume that abstract art means it's not representational. But actually, like, there's images there of, like, bacteria that look incredibly abstract, and then the relationship, obviously, to nature and form, that maybe actually this is a language that was trying to represent reality.
Yeah,
just through a different lens.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what, again, going back to this idea of what draws us to her imagery, is just this idea, any picture, any canvas where you stand in front of, you just get this sense of this is the vital energy of life. Like, it actually gives you life when you stand in front of it, because she just spent all that time with her peers, not alone, investigating this. And I think they all kind of fed into one another. And what I'm also quite excited about is seeing is if Anna Cassell's going to have her moment too, because we have a couple of her works in the section in the ether that Lily was talking about next to De Femme. So again, you see that there is this shared imagery, this shared vocabulary. And also Anna Cassell was an artist who's in De Femme, who's work was going to be housed in the temple that Hilma was wanting to conceive. So again, she didn't even just think of a space to just house her own works, but other people's too.
Just to go back to this idea of the spirits coming through Hilma and Anna and the rest of the De Femme, and this automatic drawing or painting, you know, this idea that she lacked agency somehow, that they were speaking directly to, and she was reflecting what they were saying. What kind of mystical outcome did she want for the paintings? Was it to purely exist in this temple? Was it more about this kind of space? Or did she have a sort of idea of how she wanted her paintings to be received, or maybe a higher meaning that they had?
I think to answer the first part of your question, I think that's one of the many myths or exaggerations around her work, about this idea that that was the only way that she produced art. But I was reading the biography that you're talking about by the art historian Julia Voss, and she says she considered the spirits more like friends, or like forces to coexist with, rather than like dictatorial spirits that told her what to do. There were times that they would always ask, not just say, this is what you got to do, they would always ask, are you ready to take these on? And sometimes she'd say yes, and sometimes she'd say no. We also see in the film, she's constantly consulting her group as well. So it's this co-effort. So I think that's also something to think about. And secondly, in terms of how she wanted people to experience the work. And again, that's really hard to say because of the lack of documentation, but what we do know is she was dreaming about this temple, which is just an incredible thing. You know, she wanted to make this spiral temple. So this thing that spoke to a lot of the iconography in her work, the spiral being this organic form, this spiritual form that represents evolution. And she wanted to put her works throughout these levels. But as you walk and ascend, there's this idea that the viewer then goes and experiences stages of spiritual evolution. So it also links to the idea of how Theosophy also values the spiritual evolution of human beings. And she also, in this idea for the temple, wanted there to be a lighthouse. She wanted there to be an observatory, because as we know from the paintings that we're looking at, this idea of like the cosmos and the universe and how it is composed, she wanted to be part of that. But ultimately, it was never realized. There was lots of sketches. We also have created a kind of 3D rendering in the space if you are interested to see what it could have looked like. Some people also say that, you know, the Guggenheim is the closest that you would have been able to architecturally experience the work in the way that she envisaged. When she also spoke about the temple, sometimes she just meant it as a kind of metaphorical space. And she also reiterated that every single person possessed one of those in their minds as well, that ability to evolve spiritually and mentally and emotionally.
One of the first retrospectives of her works was at the Guggenheim in New York. So it was sort of extraordinary that this vision that she'd had of a spiral space for her work sort of physically came into being many years later.
It broke attendance records, that exhibition, which is brilliant because at the time, not many people knew what to do with her work. Perhaps we could watch the second clip, which I think shows you people looking at her paintings for the first time.
Is it finished?
Yes, it's finished.
So unusual. I didn't paint it myself.
What do you mean?
You did, Hilma. You painted it.
I was holding the brush. But I didn't paint it myself.
But I don't know. It's wonderful. There was the spirit.
It was the spirits. It's unusual. That comment really jumped out at me from that scene. I mean, but there was really nothing to compare it to at the time, right, Lily?
Yeah. I think it's hard to actually fathom how it would have been to see this imagery. Because we're so used to nowadays seeing abstract imagery, not just in painting, but just in advertising and social media and everywhere. It's just completely normalized. And the proliferation of colour, that we see many more colours than they would have historically. So yeah, I think it's hard to actually get our heads in the space of a world that hadn't seen art like this and how it would feel then to see this as art.
Was that the reaction from people at the time? Did they see it as art?
I think, again, that we know that it was ignored. It's hard to say how rejected it was. I'm not sure how many people were actually exposed to it because she didn't necessarily show in the big painting exhibitions that people that we know of the time did. She wasn't showing in the group exhibitions of like Kandinsky and all of the Malevich and the abstract bigwigs. She selected who she wanted to show the works to. We know that she was looking for kindred spirits of those who were interested in the spiritual, in the art. There's also something to say about the fact that she made the decision that her works were not to be shown to people until 20 years after her death. She went through her whole archive and marked those ones that she wanted to be seen, and the rest were destroyed. So I'm also thinking a lot about all of those works we will never get to see. I don't even know what they could have been. And I think there's something quite spectacular about the fact that she almost kind of was trying to manifest the right time to show her works to the right people. There's also an act of service in the way that she selected that moment, because I was walking through the show with some people today, actually. I feel like there was a service to humanity in the way that she was making these works. I know the fact that she was thinking about, for example, like plant beings. In the ether, there is a book where she documents all of the mosses, lichens, and flowers that were in and around her. Because at the time that she was making this book, she was really disturbed by the fact that war was happening, and she wasn't really sure what the rebuilding process would be. So she was thinking about how plants could be the way in which to rebuild the future. And I'm thinking about how that resonates with us right now, the fact that we're connecting or reconnecting with our animal and plant kin, because we know that's the way to kind of get us back on track. So it's just really interesting that all of these things that she was thinking with and thinking through, I think we're more receptive to it now than anyone would have been back then.
How do you feel about the argument that Rudolf Steiner, we know that she sent her work to him, that she tried to show it to him several times, and that he wasn't very receptive and even was quite dismissive. And so there's kind of speculation around how big an impact that had on her decision to not show her work, that somebody who was a big kind of leader in the spiritual society at that time, who she saw as her soulmate and had been trying for many years to get his approval, rejected her. The speculation is that that was potentially one of the main reasons she decided to not show her work publicly in her lifetime.
So that definitely was brought up. And again, there's, I think, mythologies around what really went down when she had those interactions with Steiner. We also know that there were other personal things that were happening at the time. For example, she was a caretaker for her mother, who was really, really ill. And also, again, when I was taking these people through the exhibition today, I was just thinking, this is a big undertaking. I can imagine there's also some exhaustion that comes out of that process. But sorry, go back to your point. I also think that there was kind of this interesting shift that happened sort of after that interaction with Steiner, where whilst there was the channeling of the spirit, there was also this then shift to, and they talk about it in the film where she talks about how she uses more of her brain and her own imagination rather than just being this channel, but this shift to paying attention to nature, this shift to wanting to document that profusely. So when I talked about that index, like what that really meant to her, she was also then indexing atoms and atom particles. So something really shifted to the immediate reality around her. And I think that shift is something that I want to keep thinking about more and more.
I want to come to Steiner in a minute because we've got a clip with that from the film. But do you think she knew her work was groundbreaking? Like she knew that it was pretty badass, didn't she?
Yeah, I think probably it's safe to say, otherwise why would she have kept doing it for so long?
Yeah. Do we think the so-called feedback from Rudolf Steiner, whose work she really appreciated, his opinion, she really followed his work, and the story goes that he wasn't so into her art, and then she refused to show it after that. She refused to show any more of her work.
My speculation, and of course so much of this speculative, you know, because there's only so much we can know, especially in these emotional dynamics, for a fact, but would be that I think it's sort of interesting to think that she didn't necessarily only think of herself as an artist, and she was thinking of herself in a way maybe as a medium, as a scientist who was trying to communicate truth and a truth. And maybe that's why Steiner's opinion was so powerful and important to her, because if he didn't understand her work, her attempt to try and reflect and communicate this spiritual truth that he seemed to have access to, how would anyone else respond to it, as opposed to maybe thinking about like how the art world would respond to it?
But what also we do know is that he did describe her work to exist on an astral plane, and also did suggest that these are future images. So I wonder as well whether that fed into her preserving the works for a future generation.
And also, you know, being a woman 100 years ago was a very different experience. She was making these works before women had the vote. We were very, very, very far from gender equality. So also, I think, again, we don't know for sure, but to my mind, it seems like that would have also played a part in, if you're going to do something that's really different and you're in a society that's like already hinged against women, it would probably be quite hard to put yourself out there and show the work.
Definitely. Well, should we watch the clip and then we can jump back into it?
What an idiot. Get up now, Hilma. He's not worth this. He doesn't understand art.
He's just a pompous bisser-wisser.
You have no right to criticise you.
What does he know about the spirits?
Hilma?
Come on, love. Brew you some tea and toast.
Here you are.
Is that jam?
Yeah. Apricot jam. Mm,
that's my favourite.
Stop fussing over her. She's all right.
I can't do it. We can't show the paintings.
What?
Cancel the exhibition.
Are you serious?
You're not thinking straight.
We can't cancel anything now.
Are you serious?
This matters.
They were painted for the temple.
It doesn't matter.
Nothing else.
Hilma. Because of one man's opinion.
If he doesn't understand them, no one will.
This is like against everything we stood for years. We need to show this work for all of us. We've been working so long for this. We can't just give up on it now.
Hilma, it's not just your work. We all worked on them.
Cornelia did a lot of the drawings. The spirits worked on them.
Hilma?
I'm not showing them.
Hilma.
Well, I get the impression that Matilda thinks she's a bit of a drama queen in this scene.
I don't know. I had fun being a bit tough with her sometimes.
What I do like about that and also the film, it's just the strong will that does come out, whether or not we know it. There definitely was a strong will by putting out this kind of work. And also the instinct, the drive to follow the instinct, that's something that I'm really connecting with. Someone was saying to me the other day, someone who had also made a documentary about Hilma, she was saying to me, she's like, okay, now this is where your journey begins. And I was thinking, what do you mean? I've been with Hilma for years now. And she said, no, now that the work is around you, you're gonna start really connecting with Hilma and Hilma's gonna start showing you the way. And I think this is one of the many things that I'm picking up on is that instinct. Everything that you're saying about being able to create this kind of work in that period of time when all of these obstacles, social obstacles and more, were against her, still having that drive, that commitment to be able to make this work, and also just the prolific nature of it all, is still something that I can't quite get to grips with. And I think that maybe it's not the drama queen that's coming up, but that just... that instinct, that knowing how she wanted the work to be received, knowing who she wanted it to be received by, knowing the kind of space, the message, all of that, I think is a really important thing to bear in mind. Because also thinking about, you know, when we talk about success, when it comes to artists, in particular women artists, maybe she knew how she wanted what the success looked like. There's, you know, the fact that she could have gone to Paris and could have shown in these places, but she knew the people she wanted to connect with. She knew how she wanted to do that. And I think that's really inspiring.
I think it's so inspiring as well that it is, as you began this conversation, that people are hungry for Hilma now, that we exist in a society that is hungry for the messages and the images, that it's reclaiming of female artists, craft artists, for example, like Annie Albers, that craft was often seen as secondary to art and women's work. And there's been an effort in recent years to sort of redress that and be like, no, there are like amazing women who work with textiles or worked in alternative means that's not secondary to painting, for example. And I wonder if there's something going on here in a similar vein, which is not just about female art, but also about like spiritual esoteric imagery. And that for a long time, we've been sort of resistant to that as art because we're in this pro-science, rational mindset, a version of science. And I wonder if there's a loosening of that. You know, quantum physics suggests that this might be more scientific than rational imagery, you know? I don't know, it's exciting to me, I think, that there's a willingness to engage with these images with real respect.
I definitely want to come on to the sort of Hilma Renaissance in a minute, but just in terms of the film and in terms of all the what-ifs about Hilma, she seems to be this unknowable character in so many ways. And as I understand it, when she gave her archive, before she died, to her nephew, Eric, there were over 1,000 paintings and also 26,000 pages, just a casual 26,000 pages of notes, but very few personal details. And I wondered how you fleshed that out for the film. And also, what do we know about her personality? You mentioned resilience and the fact that she was very self-starting, and they created, 193 paintings in 14 series between the years of 1906 and 1915. So, you know, really quite prolific, like you said. What else do we know about Hilma the person?
Well, I think we're fairly confident that she was involved with relationships with several of the other women for many years.
She was quite gender fluid in her
approach. And that's what I was going to say. I think the impression I've gotten from researching her was that there was this interest in her own life and very clearly in the work of looking at polarities of binaries, good, evil, masculine, feminine, and maybe trying to embody both.
It seems like she had a masculine alter ego. There's also a great photograph of her dressed, I think it's from 1906, dressed as a clown,
yeah,
at a birthday amazing party. So she had a sense of humour. Yeah. We can guess.
So yeah, we worked with a very, very good psychic in Sweden and did a seance, and I think all of us found that very, very helpful and useful for drawing on the information. And one of the things he said was that they would dress up as men and women, like the beginning of their period, they stopped doing it after how many years, but towards the beginning, they were really trying to play with different gender roles. And so they would, when they met every week, that was one of the things they played with, was dressing up as men and vice versa. So I don't know, little anecdotes like that are quite interesting of this experimentation that I think the group were involved with, of playing with different ideas and constructs.
And we're still going to find out more about her and the five as time goes on. I mean, new discoveries about her keep happening all the time. We talked about all these myths that exist around her that are being debunked every year by different books, different notebooks, different discoveries. I think the other thing that's so fascinating is just, and we touched on it at the beginning, but just this idea of how she was shut out, or maybe she wasn't shut out. So we see in that film clip, Steiner saying that she doesn't want to show her work, but actually she did show her work. She showed her work in London in the 1920s. There were some exhibitions that she did do. Do we sort of buy into this, or do we want to sort of create this idea of she didn't want her work to be shown, then perhaps she failed a bit, or perhaps she was unwanted?
Again, this idea that, you know, she stayed in Sweden, that's, like you said, not true. She travelled profusely as well, still within Europe, but she did. And we know that she put together mini portfolios of her work, because obviously they're way too big to take. And that was in and of itself a huge undertaking, organising photographers to come. And then she would paste every single image of those 193 paintings into these 10 books. She hand-painted them over the photographs, so they resembled these images. And she went to people to show the work. So that's how the connection to London happened. That's how she was able to show her work to Steiner. So I think that's quite an interesting point that I've actually not considered, is this idea of the failings of it too. And we know that she wasn't commercially successful too, even through the film and through letters. Money was a bit of an issue. But at the same time, I think it's quite interesting that the majority of her work has not entered into the market either. And I wonder whether that was a staunch position that she took. That's something that I don't necessarily know. And whether that's also wrapped in to why we have not been able to be so exposed to the work.
With the art world, often the value of the work, like what prices they command, will then in some ways indicate how successful the artist or how popular the artist is at a given time. And the fact that her work hasn't been in the public market because it was hidden for so long and then now is largely controlled by the family foundation that manage it. Do you think that that's challenged the art world's ability to sort of place her? Because you're not able to say, oh, she makes 20 million a piece in an auction or whatever it is. Mm. Like, how does that play into the dynamics?
I think for sure you are right there. That, and I think that's also feeding into the idea of, yeah, whether she's been accepted or ignored. But just generally, this, there's so many factors within Hilma af Klint's work and portfolio that enable her not to be so comfortably placed.
Placed, yeah.
And I think that's why there is all of these myths as well. But I think also what I feel is really interesting here is the moment of the time that she wanted to see her images being exposed is now. And I think that what's also exciting about this is NFTs are being made. Also, the VR experience of the temple is being made. So there's this immersive quality to her work that I think people are really responding to. The future paintings that she made, well, that future that she has possibly manifested.
Womanifested.
Yeah.
I feel like the effect that seeing her work has is priceless. And there's a brilliant moment in a documentary that's available online about Hilma's life, which I do urge you to watch. It's brilliant. And in it, a scientist whose name I can't remember, but he talks about how we've forgotten how to marvel. And Hilma's work invites you to marvel, which I think is a really beautiful idea. And you can't put a price on that.
I don't know about everyone else here, but when I went this morning to look at it, it's very emotional. It's like meditative almost. It's like my brain kind of goes a bit more quiet.
For sure. And I can't speak for all of you, but I know for me, over the past couple of years, my attention span is getting shorter and shorter. But there's something about the quality of those paintings, I'm able to focus more as well, because every time I go into the space, even though I can look at the same painting over and over again, I notice different things. I notice more. So there's always something to draw my attention to. And I witnessed something quite lovely, actually, as I was going through the space just before we came here. I'm really moved by how many people are lingering around the work and are drawing people into conversation. Like, I saw this group of girls that would say, "That one's me and that one's you." And I was just thinking, that is so sweet, because she, as an artist from the 1900s, is asking us to, firstly, to work harder around the world. Like, we can let these images wash over us, but actually she's getting us to look closer again. She's asking us to pay attention. And I think that's the kind of sensibility that we wanted to encourage by making this show in the first place. We want people to learn to pay more attention to things around them in their daily lives, to kind of develop akin with plant folk and animal folk, because that interconnectedness, that's what she believed in.
That feels like a lovely place to throw it open to our wonderful audience. I think we've got time for just a few quick questions.
Hi, everybody. The film looks fantastic, so I'll definitely be watching that later. So thanks, Lily, for that. I mean, one thing that's always interested me has been the abstract, and whether that's abstract art, music, astrophysics, mathematics. It seems to me like you guys have talked about the spirit kind of guiding Ilma to produce these works. And it's like the spiritual is creating the logical with a lot of this stuff. So I can see a lot of geometric shapes, algebraic symbols. And I just wanted to get your guys' thoughts on that, because I think that the things are often seen distinctly. But I think here it seems like the spiritual has created the logical, the mathematical, the scientific. And maybe just one other observation, Lily, you talked about quantum mechanics. And, you know, quantum mechanics is kind of like an unreal thing that makes up the real world. And also maybe the parallels between that and Hilma's art.
A just very quick answer. Yeah, I think, to my mind, part of theosophy and the spiritual practices that she was interested in the work was this idea of everything being connected. And there is a kind of invisible web behind everything made visible. And so to me, that's sort of why I was saying, to my mind, we call it abstract, but maybe actually it's quite representational. It's just different to the representation we see with our open eyes, you know, every day, but it's still representation of the deeper part of reality.
And also, just to add that, while we've been focusing on the spiritual in this particular talk, in the exhibition itself, we were also trying to evoke the idea that she was drawn to, you know, natural sciences, physical sciences, like we were talking earlier, all of the innovations that were happening at the time, she would definitely have been very taken by that. And also, like I mentioned earlier, the fact that in her own blood, cartography, which is a very precise practice, was something that she was really familiar with. I think what comes together in her art is the physical and the metaphysical too.
I think she'd have loved quantum physics as well. Can you imagine? Yeah. I feel like she's like a quantum physics painter.
Yeah.
It's almost like somehow calling her a mystic sort of undermines all of this other stuff that's going on. We see that and we think, oh, that's exciting. You know, I've got some tarot cards or whatever.
I actually have to say, and I want to hear your thoughts on this review that came out on the show. And I didn't read the whole thing. I sort of just at the headline. But it felt so belittling. The author of this Guardian article basically said, "Swedish mystic has nothing on the great master." It was like the use of mystic was being used to not call her an artist.
We were very careful in the language that we use around Hilma's work, because we were very conscious of that. And again, conscious of the fact that maybe that's also one of the reasons why she has been ignored, because people just associate that with her work as opposed to all of the multi-disciplines that she was interested in.
That's why they're making the comparison with craft, because it's like these belittling kind of labels, like mystic, craft, that's like, oh, it's not as important as art.
Any other questions? No? Oh, one more, last one.
I'm very curious to hear more about the choice of having her work sit next to Mondrian, and where did that stem from? And if you think that she would have liked to share the same room with another artist, let alone a male artist.
Well, I'm just going to answer first and foremost, I cannot speak for her. As we know, it is so hard to know the ins and outs of the inner mechanisms of Hilma Afkin. But in terms of the actual show itself, so generally at Tate Modern, we do quite a few pairings, and we do that through partnerships with other museums. And so the museum that we're partnering with for this exhibition is the Kunstmuseum in The Hague in the Netherlands, and they are one of the biggest holders of Mondrian's works in the world. So it just felt like this opportunity to work with Mondrian and revisit and refresh his work and look at it through a contemporary perspective. And it just felt like this pairing feels right. Mondrian becomes a bit more human in relation to Hilma's work, and Hilma becomes more, maybe taken a bit more seriously in relation to Mondrian's work and his trajectory. I hope that pairing these two artists really encourages a different sensibility in viewers when they leave the museum and kind of occupy the world around them.
The exhibition Forms of Life runs at Tate Modern in London until 3rd of September 2023. So do go and see it and marvel for yourself. And the film Hilma is streaming now on Viaplay. And thank you to Amrita Dali and to Lily Carl and to Tate Lates for having us. I'm Kate Hutchinson, and this has been The Last Bohemians Live. Enjoy your bank holiday weekend.
Thank you.